There we go. All right, last week we finished up on page 24 of your supplementary notes. The supplementary notes, of course, have been provided to tell you where I'm coming from as your instructor. And you don't have to accept all my positions and all that, but at least you need to know why I'm going to say what I'm going to say. So that's the purpose for the supplementary notes at the beginning of this lesson. So we're in session four now. We haven't quite got into chapter one. Last week we finished up by looking at the covenants. We had looked at the Abrahamic covenant and the Mosaic covenant. Then we explored the idea of the discipline associated with the covenants, because we need to keep clear in our mind that just because the Abrahamic covenant is unconditional and eternal does not mean that it's free from the need to obey and discipline for disobedience. So we looked at the discipline of the Abrahamic covenant, and now we're ready to move into the Mosaic covenant. The Mosaic covenant, again, a very different covenant. It is a temporary and conditional covenant. It is not an unconditional and eternal. It is conditional and temporary. And because it is conditional, the blessings and the cursings of the covenant, the discipline for disobedience is much more prominent in the Mosaic covenant. So let's take a look at the blessings and cursings of the Mosaic covenant. Now this is covered in Leviticus 26 and in Deuteronomy 28. Those two chapters cover the blessings and cursings of the Mosaic covenant. On your page 25, you've got the slides I'm going to put up, and I'll build those slides for you as we go through this very quickly. But we'll go through Leviticus 26 primarily. We'll hit Deuteronomy 28 just for a moment, and we'll come back to Leviticus 26 again. They are virtually identical chapters, a little bit of additional information if you combine the two together. The law of recurrence, right? Not contradiction. So let's take a look at the beginning of the chapter. The beginning of Leviticus 26 deals with the blessings of the Mosaic covenant. Starting in verses 1 and 2, the Lord lays out very clearly that obedience is required, obedience to the Mosaic covenant. In verses 3 and 4, the conditional nature of the blessing is laid out very clearly. If you obey, I will bless. If you obey, then I will bless. And then in verses 5 through 8, the blessings are enumerated. If you obey, I will bless you with prosperity, with security, and with peace. Moving on to verses 9 through 13, the most significant blessing is then laid out, which is the blessing of God's presence. I will be with you. Hey, hi, Kyle.
Hey.
Glad to see you here. This is Josh's compadre at Sarel in March. Okay, so the most significant blessing, God's presence. We will witness God's presence. Now that's the way it should have been right there, but unfortunately, we are characterized as a stubborn and stiff-necked people, so we have not been obedient to God, and so the curses are the aspect of the Mosaic covenant that's dominated our history, unfortunately. And God moves into the curses in verses 14 through 17. He says, okay, but if you disobey the Mosaic covenant, then I will curse you with sickness, harassment, and insecurity. Moving on to verses 18 through 20, if you still continue to disobey me, you don't get the message, I will then curse you with drought and famine. And you know, as I look at those two pieces of the outline, it looks like modern Israel today, right? We've got our share of sicknesses in Israel, but we're also being harassed by our enemies within and without. Security is our number one issue, and guess what we're suffering from? Drought. We've had a bad, bad year last year. So anyway, we are a disobedient people, and we are feeling that even today. Okay, if you still don't obey me, I will send wild animals in your midst, and you will suffer from them. Now, all these curses were experienced before and during the Assyrian invasion. And this next chart is on page, the bottom of page 26, the next page in your outline. So we're going to build a little bit of a chronological view of the blessings and cursings of the Mosaic Covenant. So this is the left-hand side of that slide. From the book of Judges, from the time we basically entered the land and conquered it and started to settle down, through the Assyrian invasions, we suffered sickness, harassment from various enemies, insecurity, drought, famine, and wild animals. The book of Judges went through that cycle over and over again. Okay, in verses 23 through 26, God continues, "If you still don't get the idea, and you still disobey me, I will strike you with the horrors of siege." And that was experienced very prominently during the Babylonian invasion. And so here we have the next chronological step, siege by the Babylonians. The Babylonians put Judah and Jerusalem under siege three times. The Assyrians tried as well. In verses 27 through 33, he says, "If you still disobey me," you think we would get the idea by now, don't you? I tell you, we are stubborn people. "If you still disobey me, I will strike you with devastation, deportation, dispersion, and cannibalism." The curse of cannibalism. Pretty serious stuff, huh? And these curses were experienced during the Babylonian and Roman destructions very predominantly. So here's our next chronological step. Babylonian and Roman destructions, devastation, deportation, dispersion, and cannibalism. The first deportation was the 70-year deportation under Babylon. So it was a short exile, and we return from that. God goes on. In verses 34 and 35, he describes the state of the land when we experience dispersion. "When I disperse you out of the land will be resting and desolate." And this was experienced after the Babylonian and the Roman destructions. There was a 70-year period after Babylon and then a 2,000-year period after Rome. So after the Babylonian and Roman destructions, the land is resting and desolate. And this is exactly what Mark Twain saw when he made his Israel tour. I think we had a better tour than he did. I think it was more comfortable. Anyway, in Innocents Abroad, I picked out some quotes from Mark Twain's famous book. He said, "We traversed some miles of desolate country whose soil is rich enough but is given wholly to weeds." See, that rich soil is resting. It's resting, given wholly to weeds. "A silent, mournful expanse. A desolation is here that not even imagination can grace with the pomp of life and action. We reach Tabor safely." So their goal of their journey here was Mount Tabor. And of course, we were in the Jezreel Valley in November, and the Jezreel Valley is now full of life and action. It's now blossoming, right? Wasn't in Mark Twain's day. He goes on. Another quote, "We never saw a human being on the whole route. We pressed on toward the goal of our crusade, renowned Jerusalem. The further we went, the hotter the sun got, and the more rocky and bare, repulsive and dreary the landscape became." So they're at Mount Tabor. They're heading south now. They go up the ascent, up to the top of the spine of Israel and down the central spine of Israel, the Judean hills, heading for Jerusalem. And it's pretty gloomy Israel tour. Not much for a guide to describe there. "There was hardly a tree or a shrub anywhere. Even the olive and the cactus, those fast friends of a worthless soil, had almost deserted the country. No landscape exists that is more tiresome to the eye than that which bounds the approaches to Jerusalem." Not exactly true today, but it sure was then. And finally, his description, "Jerusalem is mournful, dreary, lifeless. I would not desire to live here. It is a hopeless, dreary, heartbroken land. Palestine sits in sackcloth and ashes." And that's his description of the 2,000 years in which the land was resting and desolate. All right, so we've gone through that experience. In verses 36 through 39, as we return to Leviticus 26, God then describes the state of the people. The land will be resting and desolate, but the people, the Jewish people, will be fearful, weak, dispersed, and persecuted. And that is outlined, that experience is outlined, well, experienced after the Roman destruction especially, not in Babylon. In Babylon, we were not persecuted. We prospered in Babylon, as you'll see in just a few minutes. Daniel, for example, rose to high position in the Babylonian government, etc. But it was after the Roman destruction that we experienced this curse to its maximum. And so the state of the people, fearful, weak, dispersed, and persecuted for 2,000 years. And this whole state is summed up in Deuteronomy chapter 28. This is that other chapter dealing with the blessings and curses of the covenant. Very end of Deuteronomy 28, we come to verses 64 through 67. And here is a detailed explanation of the state of the people. Moreover, the Lord will scatter you among all peoples, from one end of the earth to the other end of the earth. That's why there's Jewish people here in Southern California, folks. We're not supposed to be here. We're under judgment. And there you shall serve other gods, wood and stone, which you and your fathers have not known. Among those nations you shall find no rest, and there will be no resting place for the sole of your foot. But there the Lord will give you a trembling heart, failing eyes, and despair of soul. And that has been very typical of our experience throughout the world. It has not been typical of our experience here in the United States. The Jewish people have been in the United States for 350 years now, and this has been the best haven God has ever provided for us, this country. I can't say that I've ever had trembling heart, failing eyes, and despair of soul because I've grown up and lived here in the United States. We are very grateful for this country, but it hasn't been the case in many other places of the world. To continue, and so your life shall hang in doubt before you, and you will be in dread night and day, and shall have no assurance of your life. In the morning you shall say, "Would that it were evening," and in the evening you shall say, "Would that it were morning," because of the dread of your heart which you dread, and for the sight of your eyes which you will see. So pretty sober description of this curse of the covenant. Now I have a little book called The Legacy of Israel by Bevan and Singer, and they also describe the state of the Jewish people, especially in Europe during the last 2,000 years. Page 119, here's a little excerpt from Bevan and Singer's book. So for centuries, the Jew lived in a constant state of alarm and often of acute suffering, never knowing but that he might be driven from his home or see it burnt over his head or be butchered by a mob of ruffians or sent wandering with wife and children to find shelter if he could, and if not, to die of starvation. There's a book in Hebrew with the significant title Emek HaBacha, The Valley of Weeping. It gives in a series of annals the record of all the massacres known to the writer from the earliest times to his own, which is the middle of the 16th century, so it doesn't go all the way up to the 20th century. Every page of that terrible book is, as it were, soaked in blood and tears. And not the least impressive feature in the recital is the way in which the story of horror is told with a dull monotony in which all separate incidents are merged in one long agony of grief. So there's another good summation of our experience under this final curse of the covenant. Now that has been very, very typical of the Jewish people. But as we return to Leviticus 26, verses 40 through 46, the whole tenor changes. And in those verses, a restoration is promised to the Jewish people. I'm going to send you all over the world, but in the end, I'm also going to bring you back. And it's a restoration from a worldwide dispersion. And that is occurring even today. So now the final step in our chronological timeline is this promise of restoration, peace, and end of suffering. And this is really a promise of the Messianic Kingdom. But you'll notice there's a gap right here, right? Something's missing right there. And what's missing is the revelation of the tribulation that's going to come, the tribulation diaspora and the Antichrist destruction that we will suffer during the time of Jacob's trouble. So that is stuck in there as well. That's coming upon us. That will be the most severe time of testing the Jewish community has ever experienced, but we will come through it, and the Messiah will return, and the Messianic kingdom will be established. Now notice on my chart, the arrows get bigger as we go along, just to emphasize that the punishment for disobedience gets more and more severe as we continue in our state of disobedience. Okay, does that make sense there? Okay. Well, that's a quick overview of the curses of the covenant. And that pretty much brings us to the end of this preliminary material I wanted to go through with you. Page 27 is an article by Ariel Ministries, Why Study the Bible from a Jewish Perspective. You can go ahead and read that on your own when you get home tonight. But then I'm now going to hand out to you some thoughts that didn't make it into your notes, but I decided to put them in anyway. And it deals with the question, why study prophecy? Why in the world do we want to do this? Let me hand out these slides. It was this material, I'm springboarding off a material presented by Mark Hitchcock in the Maranatha 2 Prophecy Conference. I was given that CD and I watched it, and I thought he had some good things to say here about prophecy. So I thought I would give it to you just to get you thinking about the positive side of reading the prophets. Any extras here? Extras here. Okay, good. Thank you. Need some here. And you guys, everybody. Okay, any extras here? Do we need any back here? They didn't make it. How many we need? I've got two. We just need two. One more. We have any? We need one more. Am I out? Okay. Let's see. Who didn't get one? Everybody get one? Okay. Good. Okay. We came out even there. All righty. Well, let's see what Mark Hitchcock has to say about this question. Why study prophecy? All right. His first answer, why do we study prophecy? Somebody like Ezekiel. It's because prophecy has a calming influence on stirred hearts, he said. And the verse that came to mind for me was John 14:27. Peace I leave with you, my peace I give to you, not as the world gives do I give to you. Do not let your heart be troubled, nor let it be fearful. Now, when you read the local newspaper, or the daily newspaper, or look at the news at night, do you get a feeling of peace and calm that comes over you? No. No, we got terrorism here and revolts there and people killing themselves in Africa there and economic uncertainty over here. And we are troubled when we look around this world. But Yeshua said, read my word, be aware of what I'm doing in the world, and if you do that, you will have peace. And that's the idea. If we study a prophet, we study the prophets, we will get a picture of where this world is going. And when we have a clear picture of where this world is going, we will be at peace. And we'll see that all that we're going through today is simply in accord with God's control of the world. A number of people have said to me, I sure appreciate the fact, Bob, that you've pointed out that Islam is not a major, kingdom of this world, that the final major and worldwide kingdom is Rome. And that even though Islam swears they're going to take over the world, we know that that's not true. It's Rome that is going to dominate the world, Roman imperialism. That brought a lot of calm to my heart. More than one person has said that to me. Not to worry. Okay? It's not that we're not going to have tribulation and trouble, but Islam is not important enough to even be recorded in Scripture. Okay? So when we know the prophets, we will receive peace and experience calm. Okay, second reason why we should study prophecy. Prophecy has a controlling influence on serving hearts. And the verse that came to mind for me was 1 Corinthians 15:58. Therefore, my beloved brethren, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that your toil is not in vain in the Lord. If I look around the world, look around at the world today, I would basically give up on ministry. I mean, we're not making any progress. You know, humanly speaking, this world is going to hell in a handbasket, right? It definitely is. And if that's all I had to rely on was my own human strength, I'd give up. But we know if we that's when we have a short-term view of this world. But if we have a long-term view provided by the prophets, we know we have a messianic kingdom out there. We know we have an eternal state out there. We know we're moving toward that. And we know that all we do today is fitting in with God's kingdom program. And so our toil, our labor is not in vain in the Lord, even if it seems so small. We reach so few people, and the people we reach, some of them don't even want to grow. You know, many people disappoint you. Well, if we study the prophets, we'll get that long-term view that will give us that steadfastness we need. Okay? So prophecy is a controlling influence on serving hearts. Prophecy has a comforting influence on sorrowing hearts. And that's the point of 1 Thessalonians 4:18. In 1 Thessalonians, Rabbi Shaul, the Apostle Paul, is talking about the rapture. And the Thessalonian believers were unsure as to whether their dead relatives and friends would experience the benefits of the rapture. But Paul says not to worry. We will all be raptured. We'll all be together with the Lord. And then he closed it off by saying, therefore, comfort one another with these words. So the rapture, which is a factor, one of the factors of eschatology that we haven't experienced yet, should be a comfort to us when we sorrow, when our loved ones pass on. We know that someday we will be forever with them and with the Lord. So that's the point of 1 Thessalonians 4:18. And finally, prophecy has a cleansing influence on sinning hearts. And we all need this. The verse that jumped into mind was 1 John 3:2-3. Beloved, now we are children of God, and it has not yet appeared, it has not appeared as yet what we will be. We know that when he appears, we will be like him, because we will see him just as he is. And everyone who has this hope fixed on him purifies himself just as he is pure. And if we're looking forward to the coming of the Lord, we're going to live our lives differently, aren't we? Because we realize that he's coming not only as our friend, but as our judge. Here come to judge, folks. Remember. And we will stand before the judgment seat of our Messiah. And so if we take that seriously and we have a prophetic view of things, we will tend to lead a life that's as pure as we can make it, right? A righteous life. So with that kind of an outlook, prophecy has a cleansing influence on sinning hearts. All right. That's where I'm coming from, you guys. Now we're at the notes. We finally made it. So we're at page 1 of your exegetical outline notes, the page with the great big Ariel logo on it. Everybody there? So we'll start into the actual introductory material for the book of Ezekiel itself. So everybody there at page 1 with the logo. All right, let's begin with the introductory material for the book itself. Everybody there? Okay. We begin with the name Ezekiel. And you see point A1, it's a combination. His name is a combination of two words. The two letters to the left of the space are the word El, which means God. And the three letters to the right of the space is the word for strong, Hazak. And so put them together, and the Ezekiel's name means God strengthens, or God will strengthen. Point two there. Now, you know, we name our babies today Ezekiel, and we call him, you know, Zeke, things like that. We don't understand what this name means. We should translate that name and name your young son, hey, God strengthens, come over here. Or God will strengthen, you come over here. That would make a different view, and other than calling him Ezekiel. Hey, Zeke, come over here, you know. The Jewish person naming their child Ezekiel has a very, very important and significant name there. God strengthens. All right, so that's his name. Who was this man, Ezekiel? Well, we don't know a lot about him. Point B1 there. We learn he was the son of Buzi. Who Buzi is, we have no idea. He just is mentioned here. He is totally unknown. In point B2, we do know that Ezekiel was a priest. We'll learn that when we get to verse 3. That means he was a member of the tribe of Levi. And point B2B, possibly of the Zadokite line. That's because the sons of Zadok will play a prominent role in this book later on. So it's possible that he came from that family, that priestly family. Point 3, we know he was married because when we get to chapter 24, we will see that his wife will die at the time of Jerusalem's destruction. And that seems unfortunate, but it's more serious than that because God will say to him, Ezekiel, I am taking away the desire of your eyes today. He was about 30 years old at this time. His wife, young woman. Ezekiel, I'm taking her from you for my purposes. She's going to be a sign. Not so easy to be a prophet, is it? Not so easy. Not so easy. We saw Jeremiah go through great agony as he saw his people besieged and crushed by Babylon. Well, Ezekiel had similar pains as well. So, we'll see this emphasized very strongly. Okay, he was married, became a widower. Fourthly, this man was taken captive with Jehoiachin and 10,000 others during the second deportation, 597 BC. There were three deportations. This is the middle one. The first one was in 605 BC. That was the first deportation. That's when Daniel was taken into Babylon, 605 BC. The second one is the one we're talking about here. This is when Ezekiel was taken into Babylon, 597 BC. And at the very bottom of the page, the story of the second deportation is listed in 2 Kings 24. So you can read over that on your own if you want to read about that second deportation. All right, page 2. Question. The third deportation is 586. 586, third deportation. All right, page 2. Where did he live in Babylonia? He lived in a region of Babylonia called Chaburah. Chaburah, point 5 at the top. And he lived by a well-known river, the river Chebar. Point B, also known as the Royal Canal. Now, we're not sure exactly what this river or canal was. It may have been a river, it may have been a canal, or it may have been a combination of both. You know, canal connecting a natural waterway, connecting a canal, artificial, natural, artificial. We really don't know what it is. But we know the approximate area. Okay, point C. It was one of the rivers of Babylon by which the Jewish exiles wept in Psalm 137, verse 1. So there's many rivers in Babylonia. This was one of them. Here's Psalm 137, verse 1. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down and wept when we remembered Zion. And this verse is a good verse to give us a definition of Zionism. You know, what is Zionism? That's a question a lot of people ask today. The Palestinians say it's an oppressive political system. The UN said it was racism for a while. Some say it's heresy, both Jew and Gentile. Some say it's heresy. What is Zionism? Well, if we look biblically at Zionism, we can come up with a biblical definition, and this is based on Psalm 137, 1 verse and other verses of similar nature. Zionism is an emotion. Zionism is an expression of the longing and yearning that the Jewish people have had in the past and still have for our homeland. Ezekiel was a Zionist. The writer of Psalm 137:1 was a Zionist. Mark Twain was not a Zionist. He said, I would not like to live here. Well, it's not your country, buddy, you know. Okay. All right, so Zionism, really biblically, is the Jewish yearning and longing to return to our homeland. That really is the biblical definition. Not a heresy, not an oppressive political system, not racism. Okay, so he lived by one of these rivers. What village did he live in? Well, we know, and we get to verse 15, that he lived in a specific village, and it was the village of Tel Aviv. Is this where he lived? Is that it? A couple views of modern Tel Aviv. No, this is modern Tel Aviv, same name. Modern Tel Aviv is on the Mediterranean. That's the Mediterranean out in front there. This was shot from where did Jonah leave from? Jaffa, not Akko. Akko's to the north. Jaffa, this is shot from Jaffa. That's modern Tel Aviv. He lived in Tel Aviv in Babylonia. And he lived, point E, in his own home. That's because the Jewish community had a great deal of freedom in Babylon. We were not oppressed. So he had his own home. Now here's a map of the area of the Middle East. Here's Jerusalem to the west. And Tel Aviv is right on the coast in this proximate area. That's modern Tel Aviv. In the middle, we have Babylonia. Babylonia is encompassed by this green area. This green area is the lowlands. This is the Tigris-Euphrates River Valley. And that's approximately the area of Babylonia right there. Babylon, located about in the middle of Babylonia. And so when Ezekiel experienced a deportation, the Babylonians took him and the king and 10,000 others over the top of the Fertile Crescent, this is the Fertile Crescent here, and down into this region of Babylonia just south of Babylon. We'll look at this a little closer. So he was living somewhere down in here. We really don't know where, but somewhere down in there is the area. Okay? All right, point six. His life. He was born in Israel about 623 BC. About age 25, point B, he was taken captive to Babylon, 597. Then, in 593, when he was about age 30, he was called to the prophetic office. And so the total period of his ministry can be determined from chapter 1, verse 2, and chapter 24, verse 17. That's point D, 1 and 2. So point D1, his ministry started in the fifth year of the captivity of Jehoiachin. Now, Dr. Fruchtenbaum was very comfortable saying July 31st, 593. I don't know if I'm that comfortable. We'll just say 593 until the 27th year of the captivity of Jehoiachin. So 571, about 22 years he ministered. Now, let me close the this first half of our session tonight with a little look at the historical background. Point C on page 3. And I will hand out this chart that I'm about to build for you in just a moment, and then you can go on your break. But point C, top of page 3, Ezekiel then lived and prophesied during the reign of the last five kings of Judah. So he was born in 623 during good King Josiah's reign. Good King Josiah had a revival going, but then he was killed by Pharaoh Necho in 609. Jehoahaz took the throne in 609, but he only lasted 3 months, and then Pharaoh took him to Egypt. Jehoiakim came on the throne in 609, and under him was the first deportation to Babylon in 605. Following him, Jehoiachin was on the throne. That's when Ezekiel was taken captive in 597 in the second deportation. And finally, Zedekiah was on the throne from 597 to 586. And Ezekiel was called during his reign. And he experienced the third deportation in 586. Now, just to give you an overview of the history, just so you're not, just in case you're unfamiliar with it, the kingdom period for Israel started with a united kingdom in 1053 under Saul, followed by David, followed by Solomon. But following Solomon's reign in 933, the kingdom split into the southern kingdom of Judah and the northern kingdom of Israel. Now, the northern kingdom of Israel was led by evil kings, and so they only lasted till 722 when they were judged by God and destroyed by Assyria. And this is the time period of Obadiah, Joel, Hosea, Amos, Jonah, Isaiah, and Micah. Now, the southern kingdom lasted a little longer. We had a succession of good and bad kings. But finally, we too were judged by the Mosaic Covenant, the curses of the covenant, and exiled to Babylon in 586. So the United Kingdom became the divided kingdom, and this was the time period of Jeremiah, Nahum, Habakkuk, and Zephaniah. So the United Kingdom becomes the divided kingdom, and now after 586 it becomes the exiled kingdom, and this is where Ezekiel and Daniel fit in. They are exilic prophets. So here's where the book of Ezekiel chronologically fits right here. So let me go ahead and hand out this chart to you. It's got more information on it that I have up on the slide. And on the back, you've got a list of all the kings of Judah. So you can look that over. So let me hand this out to you briefly. And please wait till it all gets handed out. All right, let's pick it up where we left off now. We're in the middle of page 3 of your exegetical outline notes. So Ezekiel lived and prophesied during the reign of these last five kings of Judah. And so I gave you the handout of the kingdom period and that list of the kings of Judah. Now this experience of Jehoiachin is recorded for us in extra-biblical material, so we can verify that this indeed did happen. And that's point 2 on page 3. Archaeologists have found a record of rations of oil and barley issued to prisoners by the chief storekeeper of Babylon, and one of those records mentions Jehoiachin, Yaukinu, king of the land of Yahudu, or in other words, Jehoiachin, king of Judah. And so he is attested to in this extra-biblical archaeological find. Now, point B, Jehoiachin is called king not only by the Babylonians, but also by the Jewish people while in exile. Now, he was in exile for the entire reign of King Zedekiah. So who is king then? How come Jehoiachin is called king? What about Zedekiah? Well, point two, from the Jewish point of view, point two, Jehoiachin was still king. He was the Davidic king. Zedekiah was simply Babylon's puppet, Babylon's appointed king, put on the throne by Nebuchadnezzar. And this probably explains why Ezekiel never calls Zedekiah king. Ezekiel only calls Zedekiah prince, because Ezekiel probably still reckons Jehoiachin as the rightful Davidic king. Now, this is important, and you've got room at the bottom of page 3 to write this down. This is important because the shortened form of Jehoiachin is Jeconiah. Ah, yes, those of you that are with me in Jeremiah, lights have gone on, right? The shortened form of Jehoiachin is Jeconiah. And Jeremiah uttered a prophecy about Jeconiah called the Jeconiah curse. So this particular king was cursed by God. And that curse is found in Jeremiah 22:30. Jeremiah 22:30. Now Jeremiah 22:30 reads, it's up on the screen. Thus says the Lord, write this man, and this is Jeconiah, write this man down childless, a man who will not prosper in his days, for no man of his descendants will prosper sitting on the throne of David or ruling again in Judah. Now, some question the Jeconiah curse by saying, well, what in the world's going on here? Zedekiah was king for 10 years. Zedekiah followed Jehoiachin. Doesn't this invalidate the Jeconiah curse? Well, Zedekiah being on the throne did not nullify the Jeconiah curse for two reasons. First reason, Zedekiah was Jeconiah's uncle. Zedekiah was not his son. Zedekiah was Jeconiah's uncle, not his descendant, not his son. So the curse did not fall on Zedekiah because he was not one of Jeconiah's descendants. So that Jeconiah curse is not invalidated there in Zedekiah's case. And secondly, the second reason why it's not invalidated is because Jeconiah is still considered Judah's rightful king, even though he's a royal prisoner in Babylon. He is still Judah's rightful king. Now, Jeconiah's firstborn son, his first descendant, was Shealtiel, the father of Zerubbabel. Now, those names ought to click into your mind. And neither Shealtiel or Zerubbabel sat on David's throne. The curse did fall on them. Zerubbabel was Babylon's governor over Judah, but he was not king. He was not allowed to sit on David's throne. So these descendants did not prosper sitting on the throne of David. Now, as we follow that line down, we trace that line down, who do we get to? In the book of Matthew, we get to Yeshua's guardian, Joseph. Joseph is of this line. He is a direct descendant of Jeconiah. And so the Jeconiah curse does fall upon Joseph. Does fall upon Joseph. And that's the whole point of Matthew's genealogy. The whole point is that Joseph is not, no way, absolutely not, yet, no. How do you say it in Spanish?
No.
He is not Yeshua's father. Okay? No way. That's Matthew's point. Joseph is not the father of Jesus. Now, the question would come up, well, who in the world is his father then? How does Matthew solve that question, answer that question? The virgin birth. God is his father. Joseph is not his father. Joseph is just his guardian. He's not even related to Joseph. He's not a descendant of Joseph. He is a descendant of David through Nathan and through Mary in the virgin birth. So the father of Jesus is God. Question.
Mm-hmm. Biological.
Right, they did have biological.
But why would we call them?
Well, why do we call the brothers and sisters of Jesus, who were the biological children of Mary and Joseph? Why are they called his brothers and sisters? Because they're the half brothers and sisters. Same mother, different father.
Okay.
So they're half brothers and sisters, so they're related that way through the same mother. So that's why they're called that. And we would call them half-brothers. All righty, let's move on to page 4. By the way, if you want more information on that genealogies, you'll have to come to my Life of Messiah class when I offer it again. All right, page 4, contemporary prophets. We've already looked at this briefly on our chart. We have Jeremiah. He was a pre-exilic prophet. Point A1 there, he prophesied to Judah while Judah was still in the land before the deportation. But point 2, his closing years, the closing years of Jeremiah are the beginning years of Ezekiel. So there's an overlap there. They are contemporaries in that sense, a little bit of an overlap between these two prophets. Daniel is our second contemporary. He is an exilic prophet. And remember, he was taken in the first deportation in scratch out 609 there and write in 605. We've got a typo there. Daniel was taken to Babylon in 605. He was in the royal court of Nebuchadnezzar, point 2. And notice point three. Daniel was in the royal court of Nebuchadnezzar 16 years before Ezekiel received his call to prophetic office. Daniel's well established in Babylon when Ezekiel starts to prophesy. He's a very powerful and influential man in the Babylonian government when Ezekiel starts to prophesy. So point four, by this time the reputation of Daniel is well established, and Ezekiel will mention Daniel in chapters 14 and 28. And then, of course, we have point C, Ezekiel, our prophet there, and exilic prophet as well. So we have Jeremiah, Daniel, and Ezekiel as contemporaries. All right, page 5. On page 5, you see a chart, a chronological chart of the book of Ezekiel. And you'll notice that the column in the middle, labeled Jewish year, is blank. Dr. Fruchtenbaum is putting together those years for us, that chronology for us. And if he's able to get it done, we will get a replacement page. So you can look that over, and perhaps we'll get a replacement page for you. All right, page 6. Let's start discussing the book of Ezekiel itself, because it's quite a controversial book. Point E1, view of the early rabbis. The early rabbis had difficulty accepting Ezekiel as an inspired prophet for three reasons. Hey, they didn't like Ezekiel. He caused them headaches. Oy, 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 you know? Why? Why did he cause them headaches? Point A, outside the land. The rabbis have a position, a theological position, that you have to be called to be a genuine prophet. To be a genuine prophet, you have to be called while inside the land. You know, you can prophesy outside the land, but you have to be called inside the land. Jonah is an example. Called inside the land, he prophesies to Nineveh, that's fine. No problem with Jonah. What about Ezekiel? Okay, he is called to his prophetic office when he's in Babylonia. All his prophecies are issued while he's in Babylon. This is outside the rabbinic norm. They don't like this. So they had trouble with that. Secondly, point B, some of the content of the book. When we get to chapter 16, we will see some very graphic sexual descriptions. They don't like that. But point C is the most important problem in the rabbi's mind. Much of what Ezekiel writes contradicts the law of Moses. Much of what he writes contradicts the law. This is major. Chapters 40 through 48, they're the biggies. Chapters 40 through 48 contradict much of the Mosaic law. Now, why is this a problem? This is a problem because the rabbis teach that the Mosaic law is eternal. It always has been, it always will be, it will never change. Always has been, always will be, it will never change. Therefore, how can you have a prophet contradicting it? They had problems with Ezekiel. Now, we don't have a problem with Ezekiel because we have the New Testament revelation. What's the new covenant position on the law? We went over that when we went over Galatians 3:19. Why the law then? It was added, so we know the law has a beginning point. It was not eternal. Because of transgressions, having been ordained through angels by the agency of a mediator, until. So now we know the law has an end, until the seed would come to whom the promise had been made. So we know the dispensation of law is from 1446 BC to 30 AD. It is not eternal. It is temporary. We don't have a problem with it. The rabbis did. Now, the rabbis had this problem in spite of their doctrine. They had a doctrine, a teaching, that there would be a new Torah in the kingdom. Now, they teach that very clearly, but they still teach that the Mosaic law is eternal and can never be changed. Well, let's take a look at this. For example, in the book The Jewish Messiahs by Harris Lenowitz, page 270, and this guy is not a believer by any way, shape, or form, Harris Lenowitz writes, the notion that the days of the Messiah, the Messiah's apocalyptic reign, will be served by a new law is a Jewish one. Jewish idea. This is not a Gentile idea. Paul is quite Jewish in seeking to extend his new, more accessible religion to Gentiles in the interest of time, as did some of his contemporaries among the rabbis. Rabbis today like to tell us with a certain amount of pride, we don't proselytize. Well, we sure did in the first century, you guys. Paul was just following a Pharisaic precedent. In his essay, The Crisis of Tradition in Jewish Messianism, G. Sholem reviews the most important rabbinic statements that look forward to a utopian messianic age governed by what? A new, relaxed law. So this is our first indicator that the law is not permanent. Well, let's take a look at some of these rabbinic statements. Leviticus Rabbah, the great commentary. Rabbah means exalted or lifted up. The great commentary on Leviticus 9:7. All sacrifices will be abolished except for the offer of thanksgiving. So this rabbi says there's not going to be a sacrificial system in the kingdom. Take the sacrificial system out of the Mosaic law, takes the heart out of it, doesn't it? Yalkut and Midrash Mishle on Proverbs 9:2, two other commentators. All festivals will be abolished except for Purim. By the way, Purim is not even a Mosaic festival. It's its own, it's well after the Mosaic law. Except for Purim, which will never be abolished, and the Day of Atonement will be like Purim. So these commentators feel that all the festivals are gone except for one. So we've taken now the sacrifices out of the Mosaic law and Passover and first fruits and tabernacles and all that. We're kind of gutting the Mosaic law here, aren't we? Midrash Tehillim in regard to Psalm 146:7. Tehillim means Psalms. This is the Midrash on the Psalms, the commentary on the Psalms. The Lord allows the forbidden and will one day allow the eating of all animals now forbidden to be eaten. In the time to come, he will allow everything he has forbidden. So now we say the food laws are gone. You can eat shrimp if you want to. So these rabbis have said the sacrifices are gone, the festivals are gone, the kosher laws are gone. So you see how they're just taking care of the Mosaic law right, left, and sideways here? This is rabbinic stuff. I didn't come up with this. In fact, this quote kind of sounds to me like Acts 10. Peter saw the sky opened up and an object like a great sheet coming down, lowered by four corners to the ground. And there were in it all kinds of four-footed animals, crawling creatures of the earth and birds of the air. A voice came to him, "Get up, Peter, kill and eat." But Peter said, "By no means, Lord, for I have never eaten anything unholy or unclean. I follow the Mosaic law and the traditions." Again, a voice said to him a second time, "What God has cleansed, no longer consider unholy." Sounds like that rabbinic quote, doesn't it? God is going to cleanse all and permit all that he did not permit. Continuing on, Leviticus Rabbah 13:3, a new Torah shall go forth from me. Yalkut in regard to Isaiah 26:2, the Messiah himself will teach it, and the reference there is to a new Torah. Finally, my last selection for you from the Messiah text by Raphael Patai. He's an Israeli scholar. I don't believe he's still alive. Great book to have, by the way, the Messiah text. He quotes Ecclesiastes Rabbah 11:1. Rav Hizkiah, in the name of Rav Shimon bar Zibdi, said, "The whole Torah which you learn in this world is vanity as against the Torah of the world to come." So he differentiates the two. There's two Torahs, you guys. This one, this Torah and the world to come Torah. And what's the difference? "For in this world a man learns Torah and forgets." Uh-huh. And as you get older, it happens more. Okay? I need green tea.
Get it right here.
"For in this world, a man learns Torah and forgets. But in the future to come, The idea is he will not forget, as it is written, and guess what he quotes? I will put my Torah in their inward parts, and in their heart I will write it. Jeremiah 31, 33, the new covenant. Okay? And this is one of 17 similar entries found in those 11 pages. So I chose not to bore you with all 17 other entries. The rabbis have this doctrine of a new Torah, that the Torah is not eternal, but they still teach that the Mosaic law is eternal, can never be changed. So it gives them fits. And that's why Ezekiel gave them fits. Well, how did they handle all this? Point D. Point D on page 6, Shabbat 13b. Here's a quote from the Talmud. Rav Judah said in the name of Rav, in truth, that man is to be remembered for blessing. His name is Hananiah, the son of Hezekiah. Had it not been for him, the book of Ezekiel would have been withdrawn because its words seemed to contradict the Torah. What did he do? 300 barrels of oil were provided for him. In other words, lots of oil for lighting and food. And he sat in an upper chamber where he reconciled all discrepancies. And this is found in the Sanshino books of the Bible. So Hananiah, son of Hezekiah, spent years and years reconciling Ezekiel and the Mosaic Law. Now, what he wrote has been lost. We don't have a copy of that. But the sad part is he failed. He failed to reconcile the two. And this is also found in the Sanshino books of the Bible. On page 14 in the introduction, in regard to Hananiah, the rabbi says, yet despite this rabbi's efforts, Hananiah's efforts, at harmonization, many divergencies were detected between the book and the Mosaic code, which baffled all attempts at reconciliation. In other words, he failed. Page 265. When we start exegeting chapters 40 through 48, the rabbi says, these closing chapters present almost insuperable difficulties. They contain discrepancies, contradictions with Pentateuchal laws, and terms which do not occur elsewhere. Well, Hananiah didn't succeed in harmonizing the last chapters of Ezekiel. But we have no problem with it because we know that the Mosaic law is temporary. We also know that in the Messianic kingdom, Messianic law will be in place. So we don't have any problem. But we'll take a look at that when we get to chapters 40 through 48. All right, let's move on then in this controversial book to Ezekiel's style. And Ezekiel uses many, many, many literary methods. First of all, point A, he uses visions. And there are four main visions in his book, and you see them there. The vision of the cherubim, the departure of the Shekinah glory, the dry bones, them bones, dry bones, right? And the vision of the Messianic kingdom. So he uses visions. Page 7. He also writes in symbols, and he records symbolic action. And these symbols are acted out by Ezekiel. They become symbolic actions because they portray the events that are going to impact the nation. So you can see 10 symbols and symbolic actions. Look at number 9, the sign of his wife's death. She is a symbolic action. That's why she's taken from him. Not always easy to be a prophet. He also uses parables, point C. What is a parable? A parable is a short descriptive story with a point. A short descriptive story with a point. Can be a sharp point too. So you see four parables will be found in the book of Ezekiel. Okay, page 8. Ezekiel uses allegories. Allegories are a story with a lesson, as you see in your outline. These are usually longer than parables. Parables are shorter, so allegories are a little longer, but they have a lesson. And there's two allegories there that we'll read. He also is a poet. Point E. We'll come across four poems of lamentation and eulogy, mourning. Point F, he also writes prophetic discourse and apocalyptic imagery, and a lot of this is found in the book of Revelation as well. All right, page 9. He's not done. Look at this. When is this going to stop? He writes Proverbs. Point G at the top of page 9. What is a proverb? Proverbs are very, very short, meaningful statements, shorter than parables, very concise, short, meaningful statements, usually containing wisdom, wise statements. So there's a couple of those. And then he also shares with us personal experiences. So what do we gain from all this? Well, we look at this and we see that Ezekiel was very literate. He was educated. He was a skilled writer. I couldn't do this. You know, I could just plod along. I couldn't bring in allegories and parables and proverbs and all that good stuff. So he's a very literate, educated, and skilled writer. All right, page 10. Page 10 brings us to the key phrases that Ezekiel uses. The most important key phrase is Adonai Yahweh, Adonai, the Lord Jehovah. This is his title for God. The Lord Jehovah, his title for God. The next most important phrase we'll run into over 90 times is Ben Adam, son of man, Ben, son, Adam, man. Adam, it comes into English as Adam, son of Adam. That's what the children were called in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, right? Son and daughters of Adam. That's where C.S. Lewis got it, right from here. And this title, Son of Man, emphasizes the frailty of humankind. Point three, this word Adam or Adam is applied to the whole nation two times only. And you see the two times, A and B there. But on point four, everywhere else, it's applied to Ezekiel. So he is the Son of Man, the frail man. Point C, third phrase, they shall know that I am the Lord. Point D, the word of the Lord came unto me. 49 times, a Devar Adonai. Devar, what does that sound like? Name of this ministry, right? Hadavar. Now you know why I'm naming it what I named it, okay? Devar Adonai. Then he has another very key phrase, the hand of the Lord was upon me. The word of the Lord comes to him, and the hand of the Lord is upon me. Now this is a very, very descriptive phrase. Somehow this describes the supernatural influence that came over him and guided him as a prophet. Now I don't know what this is, I'm not a prophet. So it's some kind of supernatural influence and experience that came over him and guided him in the writing of this material. Now the very influential Jewish commentator Rashi, Rabbi Shlomo ben Yitzhaki, Rashi says, it was like being in the grasp of a mighty hand. Like being in the grasp of a mighty hand. And I like that description, but I don't think Rashi knows what he's talking about. Because Rashi was not a prophet either. But I do know a Jewish dude who does know what he's talking about, and that's Peter. 2 Peter 1:21. Here's the way Peter describes this experience. Peter says, no prophecy was ever made by an act of human will, but men moved by the Holy Spirit spoke from God. Here's that same experience as Peter describes it. The Amplified New Testament expands that idea a little bit for us. For no prophecy ever originated because some man willed it to do so. It never came by human impulse, but men spoke from God who were borne along, moved, impelled by the Holy Spirit. And the English Standard Version, the NIV, translate that idea, carried along. Borne along, moved, impelled. So that's the best we can do to describe this experience that the prophet went through. Peter knew what it was like because he was writing divine revelation. So he does his best to explain it to us. All right, page 11. Point F. Another very important phrase that we will see, or two very important phrases, are the phrases the glory of the God of Israel and the glory of Jehovah. Now, Dr. Fruchtenbaum has it written, it says 11 times that appears, but he didn't give us the verses, so I went to my Bible program, NASB, and I looked up the glory of God, and I came up with 5 hits, and then I had it look for the glory of Jehovah in Ezekiel, and it came up with 9 hits. So let me go ahead and give you these verses, and then we'll call it quits for the night. Okay, both of these phrases describe the Shekinah glory, you know, the glory of God. So the glory of God appears 5 times, Ezekiel 8:4, Ezekiel 9:3, Ezekiel 10:19, Ezekiel 11:12, Ezekiel 43:2. That's the phrase, the glory of God. And then the phrase, the glory of Jehovah, 9 times, Ezekiel 1:28, Ezekiel 3:12, Ezekiel 3:23, Ezekiel 10:4, 10:18, 11:23, 43:4, 43:5, and the one that's easy to remember, 44:4, 44:4. So those are the appearances of this term, the glory of God or the glory of Jehovah. Now, since we're introducing you to the concept of the Shekinah at this point, I ran off an article from the New Bible Dictionary on the Shekinah. And so I'd like you to read this and just be more familiar with this idea of the Shekinah glory. So let me pass this out to you again if you want to stick it under your, in the front, under all your buff sheets, or here where I hand it out to you. It's totally up to you. But this particular article you can read tonight to put yourself to sleep. And it is on the Shekinah glory.